So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You know, last week was Tornado Awareness Week, and today we'll be taking a little closer look at tornadoes with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And soon to join us, John Martin, he is a professor in that same department. So for the meantime, great to have you back, Steve Ackerman.
Yeah, it's great to be here again on this beautiful day.
Maybe as you listen to Steve and I talk, you may have some questions about the weather or climate. And, you know, we're going to talk a little about tornadoes. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got a tornado experience to share or maybe a photo. If you've got a photo, a weather photo or maybe a tornado photo, you can post it up on our Facebook page, titled The Larry Mueller Show. But you can also email us with experiences or comments at ideas@wpr.org or call with those experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with questions, comments, experiences. And tornadoes are no fun.
I have never seen one, and I have no interest in seeing one. I saw a water spout, and that was enough for me, because that just looks violent.
We had one come through. I could watch it go across a field behind our home.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it was the same one that...
Is that the one that hit Stoughton, or...
No, it was a different... This one was... Actually, my dad was at a local restaurant bar, and it came across, and it's out, the place is out kind of in the countryside.
Oh, okay. Huh.
And they watched it coming right at the establishment. And my dad said, no, we all just sat there watching it, and there was a road just before that was perpendicular to the path of the tornado. It hit the ditch and bounced over the top of this restaurant bar.
Wow.
And continued on its way.
They were lucky.
And then it went down the road to where I was living. And one experience. They're no fun.
As that suggests, they have very erratic paths, too. So, you can't count them on traveling in a straight line. And they move pretty quick. So
They watched it take out a barn. And then it kept on coming right at them. Nobody ran downstairs to the basement. We all sat there.
Is why they have Tornado Awareness Week now. Let people know you should not just stand there and watch it, nor should you go get your video camera, nor should you get in the car and drive.
Oh, man. What's the weather? What are the conditions that you need to produce a tornado?
Well, we're entering that now for the U.S., and you need really like three fundamental conditions. One is you need warm, moist air near the ground. Because it's that moisture that converts into liquid water drops or ice water drops, and that releases a lot of energy into the storm. So you need that. You need winds that change with altitude, so that'll give you the rotation in the storm that you need. And then you need something to kick it off. You know, a lot of times that's solar heating. That's why one reason why in the summertime we tend to get tornadoes, spring and summer, because those three things align. Good forcing mechanism, low-level moisture, and wind shear.
Well, you've been doing some simulated tornado research. Are you not?
One of our colleagues is, and he's gotten a lot of promos, if you will. He's been on the Weather Channel and other places. He's been able to simulate it. I thought it would be years before somebody would be able to actually simulate a tornado in a numerical weather prediction cloud model. And it's just fascinating to see it develop, which means, you know, now that we can do that, now we know how to, I mean, the models are our laboratories in the atmosphere. So now that he's gone ahead and generated, now we can look and say, okay, well, suppose we change this, what would have happened? And suppose we change this, what would have happened? And that gives us insight into improving forecasting of these things.
Well, we'll talk some more about that. Jim in Manitowoc, though, has a question.
Hi. I hate to interrupt about the tornado part because that is so important and so interesting. But I've always been curious about gusts of wind. I understand that wind is a change in pressure gradient, but why, you know, you got a 20-mile-an-hour wind and then all of a sudden gusts up to 40 and 50. And the other thing, when I'm flying and I'm looking down at clouds, it's not a uniform drop. There are canyons. There are, you know, places where it bumps up and places where it's way down. Just kind of curious what's going on with those two situations.
Yeah, that's a really good question. With regard to the wind gusts, you know, because the terrain is varying, is because we have buildings and everything, that generates a bunch of what we'll call mechanical turbulence as opposed to heating turbulence. Whereas the air flows around a building or interacts with a tree or goes up a hill, it generates slight pressure gradients that make these wind gusts. And so you can get a puff of air just pick up. And, you know, it's hard to determine where that came from. But they happen. And actually, as you're saying that, I'm trying to think of if there is a particular definition for a wind gust. You know, does it have to have a time limit, or, you know, so it can't exceed a certain amount of time? I'm not sure about that. You know, because usually you think of it as a puff of wind that just comes and boom and destroys your umbrella and then it's gone, you know, in a rainy day.
That's what I always think of as a wind gust.
Yeah, it's a short duration. Quick. Yeah. But I don't know if there's actually a time definition on that, you know, that it has to be less than 3 seconds or something. I don't think there is, but
I haven't heard one.
Jim? And then your second question was about being in a plane and seeing clouds.
Yeah, looking down the clouds from above and seeing all these canyons and everything. Again, you know, clouds are water vapor up in the air or moisture up in the air, but one would kind of intuitively guess that they ought to be relatively even, and yet that very seldom is the case.
Yeah, that's really good, because up above they'll look very different, but from the ground all the bases will generally be flat and at the same altitude, because they form as air near the ground gets heated and the air rises, and then eventually as it rises it expands and cools, and then condensation occurs, and that generally occurs at the same level, the lifted condensation level. But then because of turbulence in the atmosphere, the tops of those clouds will not be uniform. You know, there'll be a distribution of them as there's turbulence as that cloud mass mixes with the air around it, causing some evaporation. And in other cases, the turbulence will pump it up higher and make it go higher. So, yeah, from the top looking down, they look a lot different than from the ground looking up.
Very interesting. Thanks very much for calling. Is the speed of the wind above, higher up, is it always faster?
I wouldn't say always, but usually it is. Usually it is. But you can have some calm air up above, particularly as we enter into the spring and have a low-level jet, you know, so it may be pretty calm near the ground, but maybe a half a mile up you got a strong southerly wind, and then you move up higher and it could actually, you know, be from a different direction in a calmer wind.
Oh. Larry in Muscadet emailed to ask if solar flares affect weather on Earth. Can you expand reports on predicted flares this evening and providing a forecast for our southern Wisconsin sky during peak viewing?
Yeah, I am on the email list of the solar SWPC. I forget what it stands for. But yeah, there were apparently northern lights and seeable in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, this past weekend. And there's a chance we may see some again. And they're related to these high-energy discharges from the sun that get caught up in our magnetic field and gives us these, you know, excites the nitrogen and oxygen molecules up high in the atmosphere, which allows them to emit light, and you get these bright greens and reds. And I'm going to go outside and look. I don't care. You know, they're very difficult to forecast. But they're forecasting them for today, so I'm going to peek out at night and see if I see them.
And you don't see very many. I can remember one evening on a Sunday night there were northern lights in Madison, and we got to actually see them.
Yeah, I think I've seen them twice in Madison, maybe three times in Madison. And each one of those was a while ago, like in the 1990s.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
And to some extent, I don't know if light pollution would...
It definitely does. So it's harder to see it in the Madison area just because of the light pollution from the city and the surrounding areas. So, yeah, if you can get out north or out where it's darker, out in the farm fields, you'll have a better chance of seeing them.
We're talking weather with our weather guys, John Martin, just joining us, and Steve Ackerman. We'll be back after the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at the weather today, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our weather guys are back. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and John Martin, just joining us right now. John, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to have you here.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
Tell you what, we have some callers online, but you can join in with your own question, weather, climate question, or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or if you have a weather photo, you can post it on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And, you know, we kind of wanted to zero in a little on tornadoes, and Jenna in Mount Horeb has something relating to that. Let's go there. Jenna, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I'm just wondering if certain areas are more prone to being struck by tornadoes. I grew up in a small town in Midwest Wisconsin, and just in my 25 or so years there, we've had, I'd say, at least a dozen probably tornadoes touch down. And I remember as a kid, you know, getting down into the basement.
Wow.
A couple dozen times.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it feels like certain areas sometimes are just more prone to having tornadoes versus others you hear about.
And there was a dandy in Mount Horeb. How many years back now is that?
Oh, I don't know.
There one in Mount Horeb?
No, Bonneville.
Bonneville,
but
that's right.
Not that far away, but that was 1984. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other town that I had in mind that
you
hear about them, you know, having the tornadoes more often. But Belmont is actually where I grew up, and we've had, over the past 100 years, a few that have, you know, done some pretty destructive damage through the town.
All right. Well, John, let's turn to you.
Yeah, I don't think there's really, I mean, in our state, let's put it that, I mean, around the continental 48, there are clearly places that are more prone to tornadoes than other places in the country. But in our state, I'm not sure there's really any obvious places that are more likely to see them than other ones, except where Jenna lives, apparently. But I mean, no, honestly, I mean, all joking aside, I think when we looked at this distribution before, I remember you brought that in, and it doesn't really look like there is any obvious places that are more prone to tornadoes than others. There may be some places that are a little bit less likely to see them, I suppose. That might be a different way to frame this question.
Yeah, that's the way I was thinking of it. I mean, you would imagine as you go further north in Wisconsin, you know, you don't get those large-scale environments that you need with the moist, warm air down below.
Yeah.
So the further north you go, the less likely you're going to have it. But that doesn't mean they're not prone to it.
That's right, yeah. And you know, the fact that Bonneville got that really disastrous tornado, I don't believe they've had any other tornadoes in the last 30 or 40 years.
With
one mega storm, and kind of puts a target on their back, and people talk about it. Oh, Bonneville, you get a lot of tornadoes. We got one. It was extraordinary, but we got one. You know, so...
So, Jen, it sounds like it's you.
Touching down or, you know, doing a lot of damage, but we definitely see a fair share of, you know, the circulation and the clouds.
Yeah, we do.
The sirens going off and all that. So now that we're up in Mount Horeb, I'm kind of always, once we get, like, the high winds and that, I'm always a little, like, paranoid.
These storms can make you feel that way. That is for sure. We were talking about it during the break. Yeah, I don't want to ever see one unless I have a guarantee of safety, and there's no such thing.
Yeah. So you're right to be paranoid.
Yeah.
To be absolutely frank, Jenna, thank you so much.
But of course, on the good news is that we have all these devices now to let us know when there are tornadoes in the area,
including
sirens and weather radio and smartphones.
That is correct. Yeah.
Robert in Ashland has an experience to share with us. Robert, hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Great, appreciate the call.
Yeah, thank you. In the mid-90s, I was on patrol in Stevens Point area. I was a deputy sheriff near the Wapaka County line on Highway 54. And I'd seen all these pocket clouds, really weird, just like little pockets. And I had to pull off the highway. It's raining so hard. I called dispatch. There's no weather alerts, no nothing at all. So I decided to continue west on Highway 54. I was in the squad car, and, you know, I seen this. It was totally blocked by this wall of oak leaves. I mean, the highway just cut in half, but like a dummy, I'm like, well, what is that? And I pulled right up, and I drove right in the middle of it. Well, it was debris, and a barn roof come right over the top of the squad car, fully intact.
A barn?
The roof of a barn.
Wow.
And it come right in front of the windshield, just totally intact, about 10 feet off the
oh my God.
Ground. And squad car rocked from tire to heel, rocker panel to rocker panel, and I'd never been so scared in my life.
Yeah,
and,
I can understand that.
Whoa. And it was a no weather alerts, no nothing, and it was going like a real strange direction, like south to north instead of the way they usually go or something.
Hmm.
And so I picked up the squad car and threw it in the ditch, and it did sound just like a freight train, you know, right when I drove in the middle of it, just sounded like you were at a train crossing, and that's the most scared I've been in the 17 years in law enforcement.
Man.
And you were in the squad car when it went into the ditch, when it threw it into the ditch?
Oh, yeah, I drove. Yeah. Yeah,
that was good not to get out.
Yeah.
So I was in, it just kept rocketing and threw me in the ditch in the woods. And then when it passed, I got out, and the barn was totally, this is a rural area, barn was totally disintegrated, gone. But the house wasn't touched, and it had an old wine cellar, and just like the movies, this old farm couple, probably in their 70s, came out of that wine cellar just as I got out of the car and was walking up to the yard, you know, to see maybe somebody's in the barn if there's any injuries, because the barn was gone.
Wow.
It just disintegrated.
Man.
And they come out of that wine cellar, they looked at me, and he said, boy, that's fast response time. You guys are really good. I said, no, my squad car's in the woods over there. I didn't come from Stevens Point to the county seat. It would have been like 30-mile response time. And I always remember that. And they had replaced all the glass in the squad and repaint it. And everything was just so...
Wow. Oh, man. What an experience to share.
That's quite an experience.
That was about the time a friend of mine was driving in northern Wisconsin, and same kind of conditions. And suddenly the car just picked up and dropped down 4 feet, 5 feet over, just off the side of the road.
Wow. So, you know, I'm now thinking of the categories for assigning the EF scale, right? And that's one of the features, right, when you're assigning is whether or not it's picking up cars.
That's right, yeah. Cars are so listed in one of them. That's right.
I don't remember what if it's
the EF. I bet it's like three or higher.
Yeah, yeah. Probably not higher, but...
I was... The Stoughton tornado that you mentioned earlier, I was doing the show when that one came through, and there was a guy called in, and he was with the National Weather Service, and he was from Oklahoma or some... Colorado, it was. And he was visiting friends in Stoughton, and he watched it, and he says, I can see it right out the window. It's a four. It's a category four. The tornado. So we had on-the-scene reporting.
Yeah, and you don't assess that until after the fact, unless you're an expert.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that was right on. That's what it was.
Yeah, he knew it was a four.
Watch things get destroyed, probably.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
Scott in Medford, we'll turn to you. Thanks again, Robert. Appreciate it. That was a great story. Let's go to Scott. Scott, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about high and low pressure systems, whether or not they, once they go out to sea or whatever, do they dissipate or do they remain intact as they, you know, circle the globe?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And if they do, why don't we number them, you know, like, okay, number 17, you know, had tornadoes in Oklahoma last year. When it came through, here it comes again. You know?
Good questions. It turns out that they are, how do you put it? I'm trying to think of the right word. They are transient disturbances. Mm-hmm. They don't last more than about 5 or 7 days, mid-latitude cyclones and anticyclones, high and low-pressure systems, respectively. And so if we get hit by a region of low pressure, say Wednesday we get a rain event with a low-pressure system, that low-pressure system may make it to the Labrador Sea where it will probably die. It won't circle around the globe. However, The upper-level waves that spawn those disturbances sometimes do have that kind of a long lifetime where you can actually see the same wave coming around the globe once or twice and alternately spawning new cyclones in various parts of the globe. So that can happen, but the actual surface lower high-pressure system does not last more than about 5 or 7 days. And during that time, it goes through a period of growth in intensification and then weakening. So it's not even the same intensity for that short period of time.
Yeah. Okay, because I always thought, you know, because you see the big L or H on the screen on the weather, and you're like, okay, why can't they just keep track of that as it goes around?
Yeah, they're all fabulously unique, which makes it so interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Scott, for calling. Joe in Hillsboro, on to you now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. Interesting topic.
Thank you.
And I experienced a tornado. I was in Xenia, Ohio in 1974.
Oh, that's the super outbreak.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Oh, Xenia was just leveled, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was with my family, and my father had allowed me for the first time to drive our motor home. And as I was driving down the interstate, wind blew me into the center. There was a dip between the four lanes.
Oh, yeah,
and I ended up in the grass in the motorhome. And, of course, my dad let me have it. But immediately we started noticing semis pulling into that grassy area, kind of a depressed area. And then we saw the tornado. And, you know, I guess maybe a question afterwards. I was amazed at how there was the local school was completely demolished.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting to see. My expectation was that there was going to be a pile of rubble, but there wasn't anything.
Yeah.
It was just completely gone. And but afterwards, we heard rumors of a locomotive engine, you know, move miles, you know, away from its original point. And I'm just curious, you know, how much of that is true. But just a little background. For years, I think the Xenia tornadoes were on the record books as that was the day that most tornadoes had been spotted in the United States. But I don't think that's any longer the case.
I think it still is true. There were 248 tornadoes on April 3rd and 4th, 1974. So that is the single day record for most tornadoes. We came close in 2011.
Or 12.
It was April.
It was very active.
But that was an incredible event. And every time I've driven through Ohio, I see the sign for Xenia. And I think about that. I think, wow, that was incredible. And as Steve pointed out earlier about the lifting a car off is one way to measure the intensity of a storm. The thing that you just testified to, the absolute lack of any evidence that there was ever a structure in some place when there was a school, that's an EF5 because it leaves no trace that there was ever a structure.
And they'll move trains, those winds are
amazing.
Really strong.
300 miles per hour is estimate.
Yeah.
Boy. Thank you, Joe, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Ann and Gillett, let's go to you next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
About 6 or 7 years ago, we had a terrible tornado go through up near Mountain. It was on the ground for 30 miles.
Yeah.
It was up to a mile wide in places and 14,000 acres of timber.
Whoa.
Got leveled.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, there was no injuries, but I thought the almost comical portion of it was near Lakewood, between Mountain and Lakewood. A man was in his house. He laid down in the bathtub, wound up going through the house and landing in the yard. He wasn't hurt, but
wow!
I thought that was very
in his bathtub.
Yeah, that's a safe place if you don't have a basement, or if you have a basement with a bathtub. That is generally, I mean, you never know what's going to happen because there are some random aspects to the violence because they are so violent and things are moving around.
Yeah. And you put a mattress over yourself, too, is another thing to do.
Yep.
To keep glass
just,
and various
keep
fragments
glass from,
of wood and stuff.
Yeah. But, there's two things I'm remembering now. I don't know, it probably wasn't the same tornado, but we were driving in northern Wisconsin and saw the remains of a tornado that went through a forest. And it's amazing the twisting nature of it. I mean, when you just look at the trees, just you know, just twisted and ripped apart, it just gives you a sense of the violence. And some of those tornadoes that do that are still seen on satellite imagery, you know, 5 years later, just because it just totally destroys anything that's there.
And how loud must that be to hear all that wood cracking?
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean,
that's why it sounds like a freight train, you know, it's just really loud.
Man. Thanks, Anna, for calling. Kathy in Pewaukee, it's your turn next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We lived in Indiana, and every spring we spent time in the basement because of tornado warnings and stuff. And then we moved here in 1983, and in the spring of 1984, I saw my first tornado, and it was the one that went through Wales and, and maybe Dousman.
Yeah.
And,
So you didn't see any when you were in Indiana?
No, I never did.
Wow, amazing, huh?
So I thought, well, welcome to Wisconsin.
Open for tornadoes.
And Indiana, does Indiana have more tornadoes than...
My guess would be yes. Again,
per square mile, probably.
Yeah, and just we're a little further south, too, I would guess.
Thanks for calling, Kathy. Appreciate your call. Yeah. There was a question online I wanted to bring up. Brad from... Minnesota emailed to ask if you know what percentage of storm chasers truly do it for the purpose of scientific research versus just a thrill-seeking experience.
I'm going to make a guess, and I'll probably make some enemies. I don't think there's much of a separation for many of those people between scientific experience and the thrill. But I think the thing that motivates you to go rent the car or get on the road is probably the thrill. And I'd guess it's in the 80-plus percent range.
Yeah.
But they do it with great intelligence behind it. So it's a scientific endeavor, because otherwise you're not going to survive. But I think the motivation is the thrill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a key, too, right? Having the knowledge of when to go and not to go, as we just heard from the police officer, right?
Yeah.
And they don't always survive. One of the really well-known guys was killed.
Was just killed recently in the southeastern place.
I forgot where it was now.
Yeah.
And Jerry and Krivitz brought up straight line winds, and we had that in an area where I spent a lot of time in the Shawabigan National Forest, and those winds.
Those are also very dangerous.
I'm glad I wasn't in the woods when that went through, because it went through an area where I normally am up there for hiking and hunting and so forth.
Yeah.
And you didn't know. It was, I couldn't recognize this land that I've been seeing for 20 years. And what causes a straight line wind, or how does it work?
The straight line wind has its origin in dragging very high momentum air from levels above the ground downward in a severe thunderstorm environment that doesn't have rotation. So they have some similar environmental ingredients. You have to have a pretty intense thunderstorm, but it has to be an environment that's absent wind direction changes of really substantial wind direction changes with height. And what happens is, in the thunderstorm, there's updrafts that produce clouds and precipitation, and downdrafts that are a result of evaporation or sublimation of the ice. And that makes the air really cold and sink. But it doesn't come down from a high elevation without dragging with it the air with the momentum that the high-level winds have. And when they hit the ground, they just race forward, and they can do tremendous damage. They can take paint off the side of a house, those straight-line winds.
Yeah, well,
so
they can certainly...
They're amazing.
There were so many root balls, you know, and these are some big old trees, some of them, and, you know, taller than I am.
Yeah.
And they're going to have a larger spatial scale than a tornado.
That's right.
So they may
that
not be
correct.
As violent in terms of 300-mile-per-hour winds, but they could have more than 100-mile-per-hour winds and cover a big area.
Yeah, and I'd guess that timber losses are worse in the straight-line winds than they are in tornadoes.
Yeah.
Because you can have
a
little meandering vortex go through a part of the forest like you've seen.
Yeah.
But it's not wholesale, you know, almost like a volcanic eruption sort of scale.
But then you don't have to cut them down.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Just have to go and harvest, and that ain't so easy.
Yeah, 5 years later, you got to worry about forest fires.
Fires, right.
They dry out sitting there. Yeah, you're right. You got to get them out of there.
They become fuel.
Yep.
Cheryl on Facebook, by the way, posted a couple of sky photos. One is I'm interested in. It's How would you describe that photo? It's a blue sky with very white clouds, and it's like two separate clouds that one looks almost like a cigar.
Yeah, they're two very different clouds. And now I'm wondering, you know, John and I, when we first looked at this, we were talking about it like capping on the other one. I'll bet it's a distance thing. I bet
there
are
it might be.
One's down low and one's up high.
And it just
and
looks
just
like
the perspective.
That.
It looks like they're on top of each other.
It could be. That's definitely a possibility. Yeah. The more I look at it, I agree with you.
Because the top one is clearly ice because it's just so smooth, and the other one is more convective.
Yeah, and there's ice on the side of the convective water droplet cloud, you know, that probably wouldn't be there unless there was a perspective issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
On that,
yep.
on the edge of the of that cloud. You're right. I think you're right.
Well, that's a really pretty photo. Thanks thanks for sending that. Cheryl sent that. Thank you so much, Cheryl. Well, people are wondering what you think about what the weather is going to be like in the next month or two.
It's going to be better than what it was 3 months ago.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'd put my money on that. I think, isn't it true that there's an El Nino brewing in the Pacific? Have I heard that, or is that just something?
I think, there's some now indications of that.
Yeah.
And
I
don't
know.
Suggestions.
I think the signal is never very strong for the summertime.
Yeah.
Until the winter, we have to worry about what that might do for the winter. But so I don't know if there's any particular unusual prediction for the coming summer. Though this spring has been the warmest spring ever in the United States, or close to it, right? Second warmest?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that bodes well for. Yeah. We're not going to have a sudden cool down. I would bet.
I mean, just the way we've been trending for the last 20 years, I would go warmer than normal.
Yeah, me too.
Warmer than normal.
I think that's a safe bet. Yep.
Yeah. And that El Nino that you were talking about, if that formed, what would our winter? Would that have an impact on winter?
That strong ones tend to make us a little warmer and a little wetter. I don't know.
And less snow.
Yeah, I don't know if the total precipitation goes up, but much less of it comes as snow.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that very often occurs with an El Nino here in the Western Great Lakes states. But it has to be of a certain magnitude. I don't know if their predictions are
going to be robust.
If it's
a weak one, we won't see the signal.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you guys are... Actually, I want to mention that next month, you will not be on Monday, Memorial Day, but you will be on the day after.
Yeah.
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
I know my days on the
May 30th.
Nothing gets by him.
Thanks, guys. We'll look forward to their next visit. Our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. John directs the... what do you direct? The Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies.
Oh, Steve does, thank God.
I'm sorry, Steve does. But they're both members of the department, UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They'll be back on May 30th. Tomorrow, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back, and we'll talk about ID tags and microchipping of your pet. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.